Welcome to episode 454 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview the first ever Olympic champion guest on this podcast, Anna Kiesenhofer, who won the women's road race in Tokyo 2021. There are a few things making Anna's Olympic gold even more interesting than any Olympic gold would, of course, be. Firstly, Anna didn't race on a professional team going into the Olympics. She combined her training with working full-time as a mathematician. And secondly, she was self-coached and planned all of her own training going into the Games. And this training was very interesting and not the most conventional training, as you'll hear about in detail in the interview. Just a quick note, if you missed last week's episode, to go back and check it out, I interviewed coach Lance Watson, who has coached at 5 Olympic Games, including coaching Simon Whitfield to the first ever men's triathlon Olympic gold. And he has coached a number of other legendary athletes, including Ironman world champions, podium finishers. So his resume is among the best in the sport, and he had a lot of fantastic insight to share. It was a very well-received episode, and I really enjoyed it. So be sure to go back and listen to that if you haven't already. Now a quick thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix and chews, and electrolyte products, and they are all effective, practical and tasty. Their products make it easy for you from every standpoint possible to execute your nutrition and hydration plan in both training and racing. And they do that by having fantastic, easy-to-use products, but also by being at the forefront of education to help you optimize your nutrition and hydration strategy. They have a free fuel and hydration planner, free consultations with sports scientists, a massive database of case studies, and lots of in-depth and well-researched articles that will give you everything from the basics to the finer nuances on nutrition and hydration. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order, and that's the first order of the year because we have a new code for this year. And that code is TTS25 that you can use on precisionfuelandhydration.com. So my advice is, stock up for the year and let that code work for you, because you can use it even if you have used codes previously in 2024 and before that. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Olympic champion Anna Kiesenhofer. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Anna. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm doing fine. Just came back from training camp in Gran Canaria. And yeah, now taking some easy days, so it's good timing with the podcast.
Yeah, that's excellent, and I'm excited for this chat. Can you introduce yourself in your own words and tell us a bit more about your background and even things like how you got into cycling?
Yeah, so actually my official background is that of a mathematician, and the first part of my life was really dedicated to mathematics. I first studied in Vienna. I did my bachelor in mathematics there, then went to the UK to complete my master's degree, and then did my PhD in Spain, in Barcelona. So that's kind of my education. And yeah, somehow along the way, sports became a bigger and bigger part of my life. It started gradually, just with really sports at a very basic hobby level during my studies in Vienna already. So that was maybe 15, 16 years back, just running for fun. And I remember, like, there was a colleague of mine at university, another student, and he had a training plan. And I was like, oh, wow, he must be like a big shot having a training plan. So for me, it was really just for fun. Didn't even know what a training plan was. So yeah, then somehow I got a bit more competitive. Actually, that friend of mine, he took me along to a race. So I did that race and then figured out, okay, maybe I'm not so bad actually. Then I did a couple of triathlons, then also duathlons, because I was really bad at swimming. That was back in 2013. And 2014, I got my first power meter and started doing Grand Fondos. And from there, somehow I got into elite road races, just because I was quite good at the Grand Fondos. So people suggested I should try some real races. And 2016, that's when I was actually doing my PhD. That was the last year of my PhD in Spain. I joined a small team there in Spain and raced the national racing series there. And in that same year, I also won my first UCI race. And that's how like everything got started for real. And I signed a pro contract and joined Lotto Soudal for the year 2017. So that's a pro cycling team. And yeah, so it started very fast and then it ended very fast as well. And I had a massive burnout that year and basically didn't complete any races successfully. And then I thought, okay, I'll stop cycling and I will go back to mathematics. And I took up a position at university in Lausanne in Switzerland as a postdoctoral researcher in mathematics. But yeah, then I started again with hobby sports and again, like Granfondos and time trial projects. Like I built my own TT bike in the basement and then did the national championships and actually won them. My first national title. And then I did some races with the National Federation, the Austrian Federation, since I'm Austrian. And it continued like that actually until the Olympics, where I got selected and represented my country. And yeah, that's where I got the big win. And afterwards I turned professional as a cyclist.
Tell me about that burnout. That's not something that I had heard about. What led to that? Was it physical, mental? How did that play out?
Huh. I think it was physical and mental. I guess usually it's both. 2016 was just such a huge year for me. So I was in the last year of my PhD. You have all the stress. I defended my thesis like in September or October. No, actually maybe November. And just before that, actually, I raced my first UCI race. And it was my first year actually in elite racing. So there was so much stress coming together. And my training was super hard. And I had a coach and he was probably not the right coach for me at that time. So instead of helping me in the situation, he added even more pressure. So I was just physically and mentally spent at the end of the year. But at the same time, I was so motivated. I have this pro contract and I wanted to train even more. And then by the end of January or something, January 2017, I was just done.
Yeah. And then you didn't have a professional team after that until later on after the Olympics. Is that correct? So you went several years without racing a professional team?
Yes, exactly. And I think it's in part this experience that led to this conscious decision, because I could have had teams, like I'm not saying like the best teams in the world, but certainly like a continental team or something. I could have had a typical cycling career, I guess.
What was your motivation for cycling in that period when you were basically, you had managed to get your PhD in mathematics, you had a postdoc position, but you were still doing these projects? Did you imagine at that point that you would even be trying to go to the Olympics, let alone go to the Olympics and win at the Olympics? Or was it more of something that let you basically have a relief from your normal job and have some fun on the side, and then it ended up going the way it went?
Well, so the Olympics, in terms of being a motivation, they were not really a factor until shortly before the race. So it's not like some other athletes where it's like a childhood dream and I want to be at the Olympics at some day. So that was never the point for me. My motivation, a lot of it was intrinsic, just pushing myself. I just love the feeling of like moving. That's, at first I was really just, as I said, like I was really a complete hobby cyclist, a hobby runner actually at the very beginning. And I didn't even focus so much on performance. So really, it was really the joy of moving and discovering the limits of my body. I did crazy stuff. I did like 30 kilometer runs as a complete beginner just because I enjoyed it so much. But then I did get competitive because that's in my nature. So I had this competitive spirit during my whole academic career. It sounds like a bit of a negative trait, but I always wanted to be the best. That's just the way I was all the time since primary school. And then it started also to become like that in sports. So there was just this competitive instinct to try and become better, and not only better than myself, but also better than others. So that's what pushed me. And yeah, all the time, even when I was doing Grand Fondos, like for me, these were races. And then like the elite races, they were races, and national championships, very important races. And in that sense, the Olympics, it was just yet another important race. The spirit was not so different from a Grand Fondo for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. What I'm thinking is that for a lot of people, having that experience of a big burnout, that could maybe take away some of that motivation for the or joy for the sport. But you managed to, I guess, retain it or at least refine it a bit later on to come back to it and come back to that same level of motivation and enjoyment of pushing yourself hard and also not being afraid of pushing yourself hard despite having had that experience with burnout earlier. So was that something that you actively had to work on, manage, that kind of return to cycling from having gone through the burnout?
I never ever lost the joy of moving. So actually, after having this burnout and quitting cycling, I was off the bike maybe for 2 weeks and then started riding for fun. But, you know, like really low volume and low intensity, but I was riding. So there was no hatred towards the bike. And I started running and being active. So I never lost that, fortunately. Maybe what I did grow in that period was a bit of hatred, resentment towards like standard cycling, you know, like the standard road racing and all the chaos and so on. And yeah, that was partly the reason why I didn't join a team, but I still loved sports. And then I just joined a local club later on in Lausanne. And as I said, I did Gran Fondos again. So I always kept this joy for sports. And once I started riding with other people, also the competitive spirit came back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's really fascinating. And, yeah, we got to the Olympics, and let's get into some more details around that. So first of all, because not everybody's familiar with how the road race works in the Olympics and some of the differences that exist between normal UCI road races and the Olympic race, and that did play into the dynamics, or it always plays into the dynamics of how the race goes. So can you discuss those differences so people understand what that's like, and also the specifics regarding the Tokyo road race? So what was the course like and things like that are important for understanding the context?
Yeah, so I guess one of the main differences is that in the Olympics, you race for your nation, your country, and not for your great team. So like in the Tour de France, which is maybe the only cycling race people know, you race maybe for Team Ineos, but in the Olympics, you race for your country, in my case, for Austria. And this also means that you have much fewer starters. So the group, the bunch is much smaller. And also a special rule for the Olympics is that you have no race radio. So there is nobody in the car behind telling the riders what they have to do during the race, which makes communication more difficult. Yeah, about the course, it was something like 140 kilometers. And there was quite a long climb then a flat part on top of the climb, then another little uphill, which was important for the race then, and then about 40 kilometers after that little uphill to the finish line. And yeah, the conditions, they were pretty hot and humid. Everybody knew that in advance. And yeah, I don't know, like most people prepared for that as well.
Yeah. And can you give an overview of your plan going into the race? What was your plan like? And then how did that compare with, I know I saw some interviews where I don't think that you thought that you were going to win, or at least that, or maybe that was something that you were thinking about. Tell us about that, what your goals were, and then your plan, and then how the plan compared to what was actually happening on the race course on the day.
Outcome goals are always hard to define for road races because so much can happen. You have so many factors that you cannot control. My plan after having reconned the race was to attack pretty early, and I had some points in my head where this might work. And one of these points was kilometer zero, and then I had a few other points along the way where I thought it might be a good idea to go. And yeah, then finally I also checked the weather forecast the day before and watched the men's race, and this ultimately confirmed my choice of trying it at kilometer zero already. That was the plan, and my hope behind the plan was that I might join a strong group of riders later on. So in a sense, I go at kilometer zero, and later on when the favorites start attacking and a lead group forms, they catch me and I can hang on with them thanks to the fitness I had hopefully built. So that was the plan. And yeah, so the first part of it, like that I attack at kilometer zero, worked. But then nobody ever caught me and I just went to the finish and won.
And did you at any point, you didn't have race radio, but did you get any information from people on the side of the course, reliable or unreliable? How much did you know about what was going on? And was there a point where your plans changed and you realized that you were potentially soloing for the win? What did that look like?
So there were motorbikes on the course that gave the time splits, but they were quite infrequent. And more often than I wanted, it was just the camera. That's why I'm always looking at the camera in the videos of the race, because I was hoping for some time gaps, but it was just the camera pointing at me. So I didn't really know much. I knew that I had a gap. I didn't really know how much it was. But it didn't really matter so much because I was just going all out till the line. So, yeah, it didn't really affect anything I did. It was just really full, like all out. I never like emptied myself so much.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Well, I guess that's a good point to talk about the training then and how you built up the fitness to be able to do that. So if you can give an overview of your training and preparation for going into the Olympics, and then we can dig into some details, but start with more of a high level overview of it.
Yeah, it's always hard to say like how you prepared for a race, because it's much more than the weeks or months before. It's the years that really build the fitness. So I was already at a pretty good level of fitness going into the last few months. So let's say like 2020, I had already some really good numbers, like on long climbs, my threshold was pretty good. And yeah, then 2020, after the season, I took some weeks off and pretty much started the final preparation something like November 2020, quite classical with like base rides. And then December 2020, I started introducing some intensity. And in my case, at that time, I did a lot of block training, in the sense that I did a few days of consecutive VO2 max sessions, for example, then took some rest, then maybe an FTP block. So I always focused on specific components of performance in defined blocks. It's actually funny, like when I looked at my training from back then, I was just thinking, wow, that was crazy. Like 6 VO2 max sessions in 5 days and stuff like that. So that was, it's really hard to summarize training, but yeah, so these were some of the ingredients. I would say in terms of like specific sessions, it was very classical. So there was nothing crazy. I didn't do any altitude camps, for example, at that time, because I did not have access to that kind of thing. So you always have to keep in mind with all that, I was working full time at university. I didn't have any support from like national funding, no team. I didn't have a coach in 2021. I did have a coach for part of 2020. But yeah, I was really basically on my own and my tools were very primitive. And yeah, those primitive tools were just kind of lots of intensity, zone 4, zone 5. The volume was medium, I would say. So nothing crazy in terms of volume.
What does that mean roughly in terms of a typical training week hours wise?
Yeah, I would say it was hovering around 20 hours. Sometimes it was less, but there were also blocks of like, I think one of my last big blocks of training were 8 days with 35 hours. But it was really quite a lot of intensity. So I was actually surprised when I looked back at my training, how much intensity I was actually doing at that time. So it was rare that I would just do, so like, let's say like endurance rides were more like the rest days. And when there was a real training, it was always hard. And I want to also say that I do not necessarily recommend that. So looking back, I'm thinking that it was a bit too much. But it worked. So that's the surprising thing. I was, to be honest, I was really at the limit, but it worked. I got better. I got better like all the time, during that period. So it was really, I really want to emphasize that I would not recommend that as a long-term strategy. And it worked in the short term, and going into it with quite a lot of fitness already, it seemed to work. So I improved. And actually, I should say also that this was not at first targeted at the Olympics, but at the selection race for the Olympics, which was in May. So that's why I started so early with the intensity, because I had to be in peak shape in May in order to qualify for the Olympics. And this really changed the way I trained, because the selection race, it was a well-defined course. So we did an internal race because of COVID. There were no international races. We did an internal race among the Austrian athletes that were kind of in the larger group of athletes that might go to the Olympics. And I trained for this internal race. And it was basically a 25-minute climb that would decide the race. And so I trained for that 25-minute climb. And that's why I focused so much on like VO2 max and FTP sessions. I just wanted to maximize my 25-minute power and have something in the tank for an attack.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. Within your weeks, were you doing several doubles, or was it mostly singles that you were doing?
Yeah, at that time I did almost only single sessions. So my typical day, since I was still working, was that I would do mathematics in the morning, like the more complex problems I tried to tackle in the morning when my brain was still fresh, and then train around noon. And so I did only one single session. And usually it was some kind of intensity, like say my VO2 max intervals, and also some duration. So even during the week, I tried to, at least like do maybe 3 hours or something. And another thing that I did in order to better combine my training and work, was to, for example, do double rest days, Monday, Tuesday or something, where I would really focus on my work as a mathematician. And then on the other hand, do big blocks of training, like from Thursday to Sunday or something like that. So there was quite a lot of block training in that sense going on as well.
Mm, yeah. And did you mostly train outside, or did you use the indoor trainer a lot?
Almost everything outside, except the heat training.
Yeah. And maybe we go into that now then. So heat training, that would obviously come into, or probably, did you do that later, closer to the Olympics, or did you do it almost the entire year from the start when you also started doing the intensity?
Basically, I only did it in a focused way before the Olympics. So until May, I focused on that selection race. And then about 5 weeks out from Tokyo, I started doing heat training. And at that time, what I did was three sessions per week of about 90 minutes. I would do it differently now. I would start with more sessions and then maybe reduce. But anyway, at that time, what I did, and it worked, I did three sessions of 90 minutes per week, overdressed, so with a winter jacket on the turbo inside. Yeah, really basic.
Yeah. Well, it works. You know, that's what a lot of people do, and I think it does work. What I was going to ask as well is, what is your, what do you consider your athlete phenotype? Are you more of a like GC or climber type or time trial type, or I think that you're fall more in that on that end of the spectrum rather than somebody who's very fast twitch. But how, can you describe a little bit where you see yourself on that spectrum?
Yeah, I'm at the very extreme end of the spectrum towards slow twitch.
Oh, that's why a 140 kilometer attack works, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I really have no sprint at all. I think it's partly genetics, and also my training was really tailored for this one skill. I never trained any sprints, I think, in my build to Tokyo. Maybe some attacks, but no sprints other than that.
Yeah. And do you think that this could be why you responded well to the kind of quite extreme intensity load that you did? Because I think when you have people with higher anaerobic capacities and glycolytic capacities, then that sort of training can really fry somebody. But when you are more limited and you're always tapping into basically your aerobic system, then it's much harder to overtrain for that kind of profile, I think. So and that can help you basically be able to sustain that kind of training. What do you think about that?
I'm still sometimes wondering how I did it. Like, not how I did it, but how it worked, actually, because it seems so much. And actually, I was tired all the time, but my numbers still improved. Yeah, I don't know. It worked. I don't know if it's because of my phenotype, but I definitely felt the stress.
Would you do it different if you were in that position again, but knowing what you know now, would you? But not knowing the outcome of the race, of course, your goal is just to plan the training block going into the Olympics and the selection race before that. Would you do it the same way, or would you do it in a different way?
Yeah, so it's hard. Like, I would have to know, who do I plan this training for? If it was really myself with the same motivation and willingness to suffer that much, I would do a lot of it similar. Looking back at the plan, I would throw in a few rest days from time to time. Like, just to give a concrete example, so I did this VO2 max block of like 6 days. And then I think I only did like 3 days easy/rest. And then I had another training camp with my boyfriend, actually, or something like that. And now looking back at it, I'm like, okay, this VO2 max block was very nice, and it's great that you did it so well. If you had taken just a few days more easy afterwards, you would have gained so much more from that block. And it's actually a real pity that you didn't take the rest you would have needed. So yeah, that's the things I would change. In that sense, yeah, it would be a bit easier, the training. I think going really hard on the hard days, if you can psychologically manage it, it works, or at least it did work. In that case, it did work, but it was really psychologically completely at the limit for me.
Yeah. When you were doing VO2 max sessions, were you always doing the same one or two types of sessions, or did you mix it up a lot with different things? And what were a couple of your favorite, most used VO2 max sessions that you did?
I didn't mix it up too much. It was usually some kind of 4x6 minutes, 5x5 minutes, about half the effort time as rest time, something like that. So quite classical. I don't even think I did too much fancy stuff like hard starts or something like that. Because, I mean, if you do a hard start, you just have less time at high power. And I didn't focus only on VO2 max, but it's also nice to accumulate some time at high power. I think there's some value in that as well. So it was quite classical, steady power, I guess. And usually RP around 9 to 9.8 out of 10.
Yeah. Could you have done another interval if you had to do another interval at the end, or was it the last interval and you were done? You had nothing else to give?
Maybe if I had had to do it for an Olympic gold medal, I would have done another one.
Right. Yeah. What about the FTP work that you did? What was a standard session for that?
Yeah. So again, I often trained in blocks. So let's say you have a long weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I would do, for example, Friday, some standard 3x20 minutes at threshold power. Since I lived in Switzerland already, we have some nice climbs. So yeah, nice places to do that. And then the next day, for example, some over-unders, 4x15 minutes over-unders, again, climbing. And on Sunday, some sweet spot, which then I was almost looking forward to because it was a bit less intense, and accumulating a bit over 2 hours sweet spots. So yeah, 40 to 60 minutes, minute climbs, something like that.
Yeah. And then you would take a few days of easier or endurance riding after a block like that?
Yeah. So of course it varied a lot, but then yeah, I might take Monday, Tuesday off or really just ride for fun. And like when I say easy riding, it's like maybe 50% the power that I did during my FTP efforts. So it's like really easy, not like some people doing like 80% of their LT1 or something as easy. Then I would take some proper rest. And I think that was really essential in this kind of preparation that I did, where the hard sessions were that hard. I think that was essential.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's it's super interesting to hear about this preparation. It's a fascinating way of preparing. Not unheard of, but it's not like the most standard way, I don't think. Is that more common in the cycling, on the cycling tour, that people train more in this way with blocks? Or because in triathlon, I don't think it's really that common at all.
I don't even know. I think I actually, how did I start with this block training? I think I had read some research articles about it. It was just a case study of a cross-country skier, a female cross-country skier who incorporated this kind of block training. And also part of it was due to a coach that I had in 2020, Coley Moore. I'm still not so sure about the VO2 max blocks, if they really are that helpful, but the threshold blocks, they really worked well for me in 2020. So I did those kind of threshold blocks, not VO2 max, but for the threshold power, I did those kind of blocks with Coley Moore, like some O-under, sweet spot, FTP on consecutive days. And that worked really well in 2020 already. So I definitely give credit to him for that. And since it worked so well in 2020, I incorporated it in 2021 as well.
Yeah. There's also a case study about the 5 days in a row of VO2 max work by Bent Rønnestad, cyclist. So that's a pretty famous case study. What else is there about this training that I wanted to ask? Now, I guess that's my. Is there anything else that you can think of that would be interesting to discuss regarding this training? Because then in the next section, otherwise we'll go into some more general questions, not just related to the Olympic preparation and so on.
Well, I think I really have to, like, because when people hear about other people's training, they might think about doing it themselves or something. And I just really want to emphasize that this was short term and that I was extremely motivated, that my life was reduced to the essentials. Like, it was really just, okay, I do my work as a mathematician, but other than that, it was just training and eating and sleeping. And I think if you had other stressors, then it would be very easy to go over the limit, and it's certainly also dangerous to do training like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Oh, I did remember one other question that I'm very interested in, which is, how did you taper into the Olympics, and also how that aligns with your typical tapering strategy for like main race? Did you do anything different, or was it a well-known tapering approach for you that you know works?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a bit more like adapting to the circumstances and navigating problems. Like, you know, with such a big travel and being in a different place, you just have to adapt to what life throws at you. So we flew there 10 days out from the race, and the trip was quite crazy with COVID and so on. And well, okay, I don't want to drift off too far, but basically my taper looked like that, that at first I did some easy days because I was so dead. Then I just did one day, I think I did some sweet spot stuff just to get my legs moving again at a bit higher intensity. And my last proper session was 3 days before the race. I did 2x3 minutes progressive to wake up my body, and then 2x6 minutes hard, and all that in a 4 hour ride. And of course, with the hot weather in Tokyo, that was 3 days out, and then just basically easy till race day.
Yeah, all right. Going into some more general questions. So you mentioned self-coaching and doing that into the Olympics, and we also said in our email conversation that it's something that you've been doing for a large part, at least, of the time over the last decade or so. So can you talk in general terms about what you have learned about yourself as an athlete, as a cyclist, through that process of coaching yourself?
Yeah, I could take hours to answer this. As you said, like, I did have some coaches during that time. So I always want to give credit also to those people, because it's not like I invented stuff myself. It was really everything is basically just copy paste, but I copy pasted from the right places and inserted into the right places, maybe, to make a plan that worked for me. At least it did for the Olympics. What did I learn? I guess also through having all those coaches, I learned that often in training or in coaching, there is no clear right or wrong. There are so many approaches, different approaches that can work. I had coaches that were super fond of polarized training and no threshold at all, even if your main race is a 80-minute climb at threshold power. And then I had others who didn't do any VO2 max training for months. And I had coaches who were really fond of long rides, and other coaches who would not give me a ride over 3 hours because they thought it was too stressful and it's better to split it up. So it's funny, you have all those contradictions coming from really smart people, because all the coaches I worked with, or most of them, they were really, really good, actually, like really smart people and educated. So that's funny, kind of. And it's just something to bear in mind when you're, maybe, for example, if you have one training that you really like, or one approach that you really like and you enjoy, and another one you enjoy less, maybe just go for the one you enjoy more, because nobody can tell you really which one is right and which one is wrong. About myself and how I approach training. In the very beginning, before having my first coach, I was very numbers-based. So actually, when I bought my first power meter in 2014, I also bought this famous book by Allen and Kogan, Training and Racing with the Power Meter. And so, yeah, you have all those recipes about how to train. You do your FTP test, and then you get your zones, and then you have recipes for how you do your workouts. So you have the section about VO2 max workouts, and you do this 5x5 at 110 to 120% of FTP or whatever. So I trained like that in the beginning, and it worked really well. And sometimes it's simple approaches like that that work well, just because they're simple and you don't have any distractions. And also, I believed in it. I guess that's also one thing I learned, that believing in something is so important, just as much as the content. So anyway, like, in the beginning, I started it with this very numbers-based, rigid approach. And over the years, gradually, I became more and more intuitive with my training, relying much more on RPE, so rate of perceived effort, and not just power numbers. Now, when I do efforts, I would never calculate some percentage of FTP or whatever to determine what power I have to do them. But I just tune in with my body, and then I know what numbers I can hit. And I have also become more flexible with my training, taking into account much more than the theoretical physiological response that I want to have. But I'm taking into account the psychological toll, the psychological cost of the workout. How I can make the workout more enjoyable, having the same outcome, you know, like maybe the weather is bad on one particular day of the week and you wanted to do your long ride that day, but is it really so smart to do that? Maybe it's better to shift it to another day. And it's not weakness to do that, but it's actually smart because doing a long ride in the rain and cold, you will get a lot of unwanted stress. And doing it when it's nice and sunny, you would get the good physiological stress without the unnecessary physiological and unnecessary psychological stress. So I've become, in summary, more intuitive, more flexible. What more? Yeah, I guess that was, like, grosso modo, these were the main changes, actually, from a rigid numbers approach to a more intuitive, flexible, relaxed approach. And of course, there were some smaller learnings about, yeah, altitude tent and planning an altitude training camp, like at real altitude and heat training. Yeah, all the small stuff.
Do you find that altitude tents work well for you?
I'm still not sure, to be honest. At first, when you don't have one, you think, ah, that's awesome, and I have to get one, and then you have one, and then you think you have to use it because it's great and fancy. And actually, for me, it has such a big cost on recovery, and the benefits are so small that I'm really wondering if it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any personal experience with it, but I've talked with some experts in the field recently, and that's kind of the gist that I got from it, because I think altitude in itself is very clearly a tool that can be extremely valuable, but then you think about it's quite difficult both logistically and it's expensive, and then you start thinking about an altitude tent would be good, then that makes it easier. It's much more cost effective over time. But yeah, I think that's also the consensus that I've heard from various different sources about the altitude tent. But I was just curious about that because I had that discussion recently. In terms of what you described about your journey as coaching yourself and being coached, also it sounds very, I mean, I guess a typical trajectory of that a lot of athletes go on with, first being quite numbers based, but then the more you learn, becoming more intuitive, and also in the beginning being quite focused on the, let's say, just the training itself, the power or the paces in terms of a runner or a swimmer and so on. And then as you learn more and more, you start to take into account different factors like the psychology and the environment, all of the biopsychosocial factors that also have an impact. So that's very interesting to hear how that has been a trajectory that you've been on as well. But in terms of the actual training from a types of sessions standpoint, I get the feeling then it sounds a bit like you find that all different types of sessions can be quite valuable for you. You're not somebody who's just doing threshold work or just polarized training. Like you mix things up and try to find the right balance of everything. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's definitely the case now. So I mix things up. What I always believe in a lot is specificity. I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer, but just training for your race, training, replicating the demands of your race in training, it's something I strongly believe in. And I guess that's something, maybe a message like for everybody that everybody can do. You just look at your race and then do what your race demands of you in training before you start thinking about fancy stuff like, oh, should I do my VO2max as 40, 20, 30, 15s or whatever? Just think about what your race demands of you. And so, for example, if I train for a time trial, then in the last few weeks, a lot of my sessions will just be efforts at the power that I target, of course, with some rest in between. And I do a fewer targeted VO2max work, for example. I might keep in just a bit of VO2max to maintain that physiological component, but otherwise I would focus really on the specific intensity.
Yeah, makes sense. One thing that I saw you say in an interview was that you see your training log as the best resource to learn about training rather than books or things like that. So can you go into some detail about, I think that makes complete sense. That's how I think as well as a coach. The nothing tells you as much as just looking back at the training that has worked and hasn't worked for an athlete. But can you describe your detail about, or your process about how that works? When do you, when you plan your training, how do you decide what to put in there? And at what point do you go back and look and reflect on what you have done and how that worked or didn't work?
Yeah, I mean, best resource is maybe a bit too strong, but it's at least one very valuable resource, your own training diary. Yeah, so I mean, when I have training diaries like years back, and I'm very glad that I started to write down stuff quite early. The problem with platforms like Training Peaks or something is like once you switch platform, then you lose some data or like lose your comments. You can always export the fit files, but then you lose your comments and so on. So I'm very happy that I have my Excel sheets with the same structure and so on since like 2015 or something. So I just write down like duration of the workout, the main content, some personal comments of how I felt. I have my daily metrics of like perceived energy level, sleep duration, sleep quality, leg quality during the workout. Then some column with coach comment, like what I would do differently. So I might write down, this was a bit too much or something like that. Or like any important biomechanical changes, for example, that I raised my saddle. So stuff like that. So that's the stuff that I write down on a regular, like every day, basically. Then how do I use it? For example, if I plan my training for a specific race, so I say I want to target the World Championships this year, then I just look if I did a similar race in the past, what did my training look like before that race? Did it work? And if it worked well, then what can I incorporate again this time around? Then maybe I know, this time I want to do my altitude training camp at that time. I want to come back from altitude at that time and so on. And much of that no book can really tell you. Like you can read research papers and they will tell you that you should come down from altitude between day, I don't know, 1 and 21 or something. And then you don't know what is right for you. Or also like during the training camp itself, nobody can tell you how much load you can handle. And yeah, just looking back and just seeing what you did before and avoiding any previous mistakes is very important.
And how often is that, mainly when you sit down at the beginning of planning out the build, the overview of a build towards a particularly important race like a World Championship or something like that, that you go back? Or do you also have a yearly reflection or something like that when you go back and look at everything you did, try to think about it, try to analyze what worked well, what can you do to improve those sorts of things? Is that built into your process somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a formal process, but I certainly do that I look back. And for planning, it's really like, it's on the one hand, it's like when I do the annual plan or like planning a bigger block, but it's also at the smaller intermediate steps, like, as I said, like for planning a training camp, which might be just a 2 or 3 weeks block, I might look at the past and see what I did, or even individual sessions, like just how many repetitions did I do back then and how did I feel afterwards? Was it too much? Could I have done more? So it's really like the needs-based, it's really a needs-based approach. I look back quite often, actually.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so other than the training log, then if you have other good resources or even learning methods that you use and have found useful for yourself coaching, what what are some examples of that?
Yeah, so actually, funnily enough, for my self-coaching, the best resource were my coaches. So I think that's really where I learned the most. But also, as I had mentioned, reading books, like I started just by reading a book. That's one good resource, of course. Research papers can be a good resource. Over the years, again, like maybe in parallel to my numbers towards intuition shift in training, I also shifted more to from like just reading books and papers to talking more to people. I see value in following people on Twitter or something like that. Because yeah, you just pick up some ideas. And yeah, if you follow the right people, that's often very good ideas. Yeah, podcasts. I really like podcasts as well. So some of the interviews that you did with coaches gave me some valuable information. Yeah, sometimes hearing somebody talk, it just conveys more nuance than reading some article.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And also with when it comes to, for example, the people doing the academic research, they on Twitter, they can be more holistic and straightforward in a way about talking about their entire knowledge rather than just being very limited in what they can and cannot say, because this it's not something that they investigated in a particular study, but they maybe know it to be the case based on other work. Of course, they sometimes that comes into the introduction or a conclusion in a way, but yeah. But you're still a bit more limited, or they are more limited there. So I think that definitely makes sense. And I think that it's also, I can draw a parallel to this podcast in a way that I find a bit more value nowadays in doing interviews like the one we're having now, even with talking to somebody that has done something in a thoughtful way with you and your training, than talk about a more theoretical study, even though it might be a controlled trial of some sort. But there, it's still such a limited scope and not so applicable always to most people's lives. So having an inside look into even just what one person did, but understanding the whys and the decisions along the way, that can be, it's obviously not one or the other. Everything has its place. But I think that, yeah, that's a parallel that I draw in the resources that I use and find valuable, and how that also has changed a bit over time. But is that, other than your coaches, have you used any other kind of experts that you have actually brought into your team, let's say? Like, have you had somebody that you use for, I don't know, strength training, or consulted with somebody regarding heat training protocols or things like that? Are there other persons that you have used, other experts and practitioners that you've had had on your team during these years?
So before Tokyo, I had very few external experts. I did work with a mental coach before Tokyo already, which was extremely valuable. So in the months before Tokyo, I didn't have a coach for the training plan, but I did have a mental coach. After Tokyo, I had much more access to resources like that, because I got a lot of funding from my country finally. And so, yeah, I did consult with some coaches on a one-off basis. I find this very like complicated, or it's a bit limited, because coaching is just so complex. And in just one or two sessions to really understand the person and their needs, like for the coach or consultant, I find it quite hard. So I'm not sure maybe if you have specific questions, then that's a good approach. But I didn't use it that much. It was just actually for planning an altitude training camp. So for specific interventions, maybe yes.
Yeah.
And
About the mental coach. I wanted to ask, do you have an example of something that they brought, whether it's like some kind of mental training that you did, or mental preparation, or even something like a mantra or a strategy during the race, like one example of something that they brought to you in your training or racing?
Yeah, positive self-talk was definitely a big component. A lot about it is just being more self-aware, knowing what you want, like being aware of your values. And once you know what you want, I think it makes the motivation come almost automatically.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always a progress.
Yeah. And so were you saying something there before I interjected?
Yeah. About the consultants. So I also consulted with some nutritionists. At that time, my nutrition was finally already so good that I didn't really need that anymore. I wish I had consulted with somebody like that 10 years ago. So that was also just one-offs because I realized I don't need any nutritionist. What else? Of course, equipment, aerodynamics. That's the big part. Yeah. That was the most expensive and biggest part for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Coming to the end of this section very soon here, if you could go back in time to an earlier point in your career and give yourself some general advice or specific advice, any advice, what would you tell yourself? And you can choose how far back you want to go, but as a thought experiment.
I don't know how far I want to go back, but almost all the time, and even now, I'm just too impatient. And especially at the beginning, I wanted everything right away. And I didn't realize how long those physiological adaptations take and also the experience. So I did my first triathlon, for example, and I wanted to have a result right away. And that's just a bit stupid. You get so hung up with your training. You want to optimize everything and you have never done a triathlon and so much can go wrong. So just being patient would be one big lesson I would want to give my former self. And another big one would be to dare to ask more questions, seek advice, seek guidance, because it got painted in as if it was cool to be this autodidact and do everything by oneself and so on. After my win in Tokyo, she didn't have a coach, so cool, she did everything herself. But it's also because I was too shy to reach out and talk to people and ask questions. So I wish I had had more guidance, more of the right kind of guidance early on.
Yeah. And the patience piece is also, I mean, that's even coming from you, because to be honest, you probably got results much quicker than almost anybody would get. I mean, you won the Olympics after how many years after starting cycling? It would have been eight years or so, or if I got the years right when you started in cycling.
Yeah, depends what one counts. So my first elite races were 2016. And in between was the burnout and so on. I think what was really rapid was my start of elite racing and winning my first race and signing a pro contract, because that was in the space of less than 1 year.
Yeah.
And that was way too little, and I was not prepared in any way. Physically, maybe okay. Yes. Yeah. I was pretty strong, but mentally I was really not at the level. You can't just skip years of development. I was just so vulnerable.
But that I think is a good lesson that anybody can learn from, the patience part. That you're saying that you needed patience, and yes, you did, but for most people they need even more patience to see results, because they're not putting in the same amount of work, because they have jobs and families and stuff, and so it takes. But also just the genetic component is obviously an important one that you can't get around. And then the final kind of part on this self-coaching chapter here, are there some things right now that you're thinking that this is something specific that I want to learn more about or understand better?
So one thing I'm quite interested in, or I don't know, it's a bit vague, but like to better measure recovery in a way, like you can feel when your body is kind of aroused after a hard session, you have this sympathetic nervous system response, and somehow measuring when it like calms down would be nice, maybe measuring cortisol or something like that. I tried HRV, but didn't work so well for me. That's a bit of a vague one. but I'm also like, just from a pragmatic point of view, I'm trying to work on that using, for example, meditation techniques. Another thing I'm interested in is like endurance rides, like how hard you should do them, like at what power and how long and so on. And it's funny because endurance rides, they're such a, or endurance training in general, it's such a big component of an athlete's training, and we spend hours and hours and hours. But especially in cycling, nobody tells you exactly at what power you should ride. And in cycling, it can be super vague. Like a cycling coach, he might give you a 5 hours endurance ride, and then you can go between 0 watts and your LT1 maybe. And so it means, okay, I can go from zero to 200 watts for 5 hours. And it's just such a vast area, like a vast interval of power. And I'm just wondering which power should we go at? It's fun. Like, cycling is really special about that, because in most other sports, you define the intensity at which you should train. But in cycling, a big portion of the training, you just go at any intensity.
I think in running, there's also a bit of a question mark there. But perhaps if you look at the pure runners, they tend to be a bit more, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them tend to be a bit more kind of not super easy. But if you look at a triathlete, then the running might be anywhere from very, very easy to quite fast. So I think that running also suffers from the same, but I do agree that cycling perhaps more so than any other sport, because it just has a bigger dynamic range where you can actually push the pedal effectively and produce power. So yeah, it is. And I feel like we have been promised some research. I can't remember who, but I've definitely had discussions with researchers on the podcast that have said that this is something that I would like to investigate. They haven't promised it necessarily, but it's something that has come up as a desired area of research. But for whatever reason, it seems like it's not at all a big interest for study, even though, as you say, it's such a large part of the training that it would make sense that it would be.
Yeah, and then you have papers about training intensity distribution or something, and then you have this huge zone 1 plus zone 2 where everything gets thrown in from 0 until X. It's quite funny. And I just want to say, I don't want to take the joy out of endurance rides or make it super rigid or something, but I just want to understand for myself, okay, does it make sense, for example, that I do my endurance ride at 190 watts instead of 140 watts? So just to have this idea and understanding. And I feel like nobody can tell me which one is better.
yeah, exactly. I agree. But I think that there's also a pretty big influence there of the phenotype of the athlete, that some of the more fast twitch, that is a pattern that I think exists, that a lot more fast twitch athletes tend to gravitate more towards the lower end of that range, and faster twitch athlete tend to gravitate a bit more to the higher end. Whether that's right or not, that's, you could argue that's maybe not that it doesn't prove anything, but that is a pattern that I think exists. But let's move into some more rapid fire questions, not necessarily super rapid fire, but I just want to hear your opinion on a few topics. Some of them we've talked about already, and some of them I might skip because we have already tackled them in quite some detail, but you can give a few sentences on each of these from your perspective, and this is not necessarily giving advice to anybody, but for you, how you view them in your personal training. So the first one is, how hard to go in training?
Yeah, so my description of the training before Tokyo sounds like I was training very hard, and before Tokyo that was definitely the case. I just, like, if you take into account the long-term sustainability and longevity, then I cannot go so hard all the time. And I do feel the pain. Like, I'm not one of those crazy people who enjoy the pain or something. So now I try to limit it a bit. I'm a bit more moderate with the pain and hardness. So now the standard would be maybe 2 hard-ish sessions per week. And they are much softer than my standard hard sessions before Tokyo. It's very hard to answer the question in a precise way. I would say, in general, unfortunately for me, when I go very hard in training, I improve a lot. So unfortunately, I really have to suffer way outside my comfort zone if I want to get the best out of me. So that's the case for me.
Yeah, well, that's a great answer, I think. Training volume.
Yeah, very hard. So I had some years where I trained few hours and I was actually really good. So I'm surprised because now in all the research papers or so on, or like in general, when you read something, it's elite athletes train so much and training volume is the most important thing and so on. And I'm really surprised looking back. I was training maybe 12, 13 hours per week and I was hitting almost the same numbers as I did like last year. I don't know. And I don't think my training last year was so bad. I was a bit heavier back then. Okay. That was before Tokyo when I was still amateur. I was a bit heavier and not training so many hours, but my power was pretty good. And I was just focusing a lot on specific quality sessions. But then maybe you have to distinguish between the short term development and the long term development. And for the long term development, I do believe in high volume.
Yeah. The difference between a fresh, let's say, 20-minute power and a fatigue 20-minute power, there can also be an impact there. But it is a very interesting question, what is optimal? Because, yeah, you need to do some volume, but I mean, I'm not convinced that everybody who's doing really high volume, that not a lot of that is kind of just too much or unnecessary. Not necessarily bad, but unnecessary. Who knows? It's hard to say. Indoor training.
So yeah, I'm a bit strange in that respect because I get really sore legs from indoor training. I don't know what it is. It's kind of, it feels like I'm doing micro accelerations all the time against the resistance of the trainer, and it kills my legs and my power is rubbish on the indoor trainer. And then my training suffers the next few days. So I try to avoid it actually. For me, the best is really to ride outside. But actually, like mentally, I would even like it because when I do efforts, I just want to have it controlled and focus on my efforts and not on the terrain or something. Yeah, but my legs don't like it.
Yeah. And how do you split training between the road and the TT bike?
So right now, for example, I'm only riding my road bike, but I should get on the TT bike at some point. To be honest, it's just more enjoyable right now to ride my road bike. Before an important time trial race, I definitely do a lot of TT training. Actually, all the intense sessions, all the specific sessions are on the time trial bike. For example, when I did my altitude training camp for Paris last year, everything was on the time trial bike except the endurance rides. Even view to max sessions, and then I would just sit up on the base bar, for example, to push. I don't want to go into too much detail, but yeah, everything was time trial bike when it was intensity.
And for how long do you need that adaptation to the time trial bike before a key race? Is it 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks? What are we talking about?
It's hard to say a specific number because some of it I didn't really plan. But for example, I had national championships before starting my altitude training camp for Paris. So I already trained for that on the TT bike. And I felt like it was just gradually getting better and better. So I don't even know the upper limit where I would say, there is no need to go on the time trial bike any earlier. I would say at least 3 months, 2-3 months, something like that.
Yeah. Testing.
Testing, yeah. Depends what you want from it. If it's just to track improvements, I would definitely just do field tests and not even formal tests. But for example, if I have a standard view to max session, 4 by 6 minutes or something, and the numbers go up for the same RPE, then I'm probably improving. or yeah, just see my race number or like power numbers from races or so on. So I don't do any formal testing in that sense. If it's for determining training zones, I also favor tests outside, maybe measuring lactate outside. And if you do a step test, then also confirming the values you get for longer durations, because there can be a drift. And if you think that's LT1 or something and you do a longer climb, then suddenly your lactate might go up. So yeah, that's basically it. I did do some lab tests, but that was just for formal reasons, because we needed to do some medical tests for the Olympics. But I have never really used the data that came out of it.
What about the lactate testing that you described? Is that something that you find useful, that you still incorporate, or?
Usually it correlates very well with my RPE, so I don't do it that often. But it was quite interesting to do it from time to time and just see that the LT1 or LT2 is not really stable when you do longer durations.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do the final one, torque training or low cadence training.
Yeah, that's not something I know a lot about. I haven't done much of it. I know that other cyclists do a lot of it. I think now it's more fashionable to do the shorter, really high torque efforts and a bit less, at least for cyclists, we do less of the like zone 3 low cadence classical torque training. Personally, I only use it as a kind of neuromuscular activation. So during endurance rides and just very short, like maybe 30 seconds at very high but controlled torque. But I can't say if it really helps. It just feels good to activate all the muscles.
Yeah, yeah. Then just to finish off, some questions. Well, actually, two shorter segments left, but a couple of questions related to amateur cyclists and also potentially triathletes. Actually, I believe that you are doing some coaching. Is that right? Or you have been doing some coaching anyway?
Yeah. Very limited, but yeah, something I would like to get into more. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, then you have a decent idea of how at least some amateur cyclists tend to train, and you can answer a question of what are some common mistakes that you think amateur cyclists tend to do.
Yeah, you know, like amateur cyclists, it's such a large and diverse group that it's hard to say like everybody's making this mistake. And I'm actually often impressed by how well amateurs train. Like those who really think about their training, they have a better setup than many women pro teams. they know much more. So let's say, since we want to target like mistakes, then let's talk about like amateur athletes who don't think so much about their training and everything. I guess common mistakes might be poor pacing in races. So I'm thinking of Gran Fondos. And you have all those guys going off like crazy, and they think they can do the first climb of an 8-hour Gran Fondo at 110% of their FTP. And everybody knows that that's not possible. So, just being a bit more realistic about one's pacing might be a good advice. Another common mistake is poor nutrition in races. So just not eating enough. In terms of training itself, so not talking about races, but training, I guess maybe one would expect me to say that they go too hard all the time. I find it hard to judge, because if you have fewer hours, maybe within those hours, the percentage of harder sessions is higher, should be higher. So I find it hard to judge that one. Maybe just seeing value in endurance rides would be something that might be an advice. So somehow we talk about quality sessions and quality equals intensity. But no, I mean, a 3-hour endurance ride is also quality. Another one would be poor nutrition in everyday life. I think that's a big one. So even for people who want to do things right, if you go training at noon or something And even if it's just 1 hour, you just spend 500 to 800 kilojoules extra. And it's just important to replace that energy right away. It's not just the daily calorie balance that matters, but also how you distribute the intake over the day, because it's a stress for the body if you have this huge deficit throughout the afternoon. And then you come home and have dinner and are starving. Monitoring this energy deficit is very important, I guess, and just having a snack, recovery shake or whatever afterwards, after your training. Yeah. And yeah, sorry.
Go on.
Yeah, maybe another mistake with training is to follow like random advice that you find somewhere, or you see, somebody did that, now I want to do it. And it leads to you like jumping around and not really having a clear structure in your training. That's another point. And I'm also guilty of that myself, because it's just how you have this shiny new object, you want to try it. But being a bit more strict with your training and sticking to one plan.
Yeah, that one I think is a big one and really good thing that you brought up. What about this might not even be just amateurs, but anybody. But if, from what you know about triathletes and specifically how they approach the bike, their bike training and bike performance, are there anything that you as a cyclist would say that that's a bit strange, or maybe this is something that triathletes could do differently to improve their bike performance?
Mm. Yeah, so I have very little access to like triathletes power files or something. But when I just see pictures or something, like what strikes me is often the position, like how they sit on the bike. And then it feels a bit unfortunate that they sounds like everybody, but I just mean some people, they spend so much money on a bike, and equipment and so much hours on training. And then they sit on their bike and just by improving the position on the bike, they could save two years' worth of training. Thinking a bit about your position on the bike, would be one point, I guess. On the one hand, you have to think about your position and dial in your bike fit. And you can do that also yourself, like you just take a camera, you film yourself and you look and at least, frontal area is not everything, but at least it's something, and reducing your frontal area can go a long way. And then training that position, because maybe you have this picture perfect position, on your camera, but you cannot hold it for 3 hours. So training in that position and not just cruising on your bars, but really making an effort to keep aero. Would be another advice.
Yeah, no, those are great points. And let's finish up with a couple of reflective questions here. And the first one is, what is the best or most influential book that you've read?
Well, influential for me personally, actually, even though it's not the best book, would be Alan Kogan's Training and Racing with a Power Meter. Because that's what started kind of my whole self-coaching journey in cycling. Some other books, one of them I think gets mentioned by many people on your podcast is Endure by Alex Hutchinson. And in general, I like all the books that teach me something about the human body and mind, because I just find it so fascinating. Maybe right now even more the mind than the body, I don't know. So for example, Flow by Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. I never managed to pronounce the name. And also Robert Sapolsky has some interesting books, like the book Behave and the book Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And they are all a bit about the human mind, how we react to stress, what determines our behaviors. And I find all that very interesting.
Yeah, no, those are lots of really, really interesting ones for sure to put on the reading list. And what is the best advice that you've ever received?
It's hard to say, because I can't really remember an instant where somebody told me something and then I would say, oh yeah, that's great, I will do it or something. And then I did it. Like, I always learn by doing. Unfortunately, like, I learned the hard way. I make the mistakes and then I learn. But maybe a reflection that was important for me was when a coach asked me, like, what environment makes you perform the best? What do you need in your environment to train at your best and get the most out of it? And I think that's, yeah, I don't know if it's advice. Maybe the advice is to think about this question. And I think that's an important one because the environment is so important. We can't ignore it. It shapes us. It determines how we feel about what we do. It determines what we do. So I think that's an important reflection and also something that I try to incorporate in my own training to, yeah, think about the setup and environment that I need.
Yeah, no, that is a very good probing question that might lead to, to a process of reflection that could have also come as advice, but I think that that definitely can go in that category, and absolutely environment is a massive part of or can be a massive part of your performance improvement. So that's a great place to end on. I think thank you so much, Anna, for coming on. It's been a pleasure and super interesting to hear from you and about your training. Just finally, where can people follow you, or is there anything else you want to say before we finish off this interview?
Where can people follow me? Well, I do use Instagram, even though I don't like it. So sometimes I don't post anything for a few weeks because actually I don't like posting. But still, that's maybe the place where I write the most. So probably that's the best place. I don't even know my handle, but I think you will find it. I also have a website, but yeah, also I don't update it all the time. Yeah. So in case of doubt, Instagram.
Yeah, that's fine. And we'll be tuning into the World Championships later in the year, if that is your big goal. And hopefully that goes well for you. It's in Rwanda this year, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm actually pretty excited about it.
Yeah, no, that will be fascinating to see how that goes, and hopefully it will draw some great interest both internationally on the TV, but also locally, and bring some interest to Africa for cycling, which I guess is the one of the ideas anyway of having it there. So good luck with that, and thank you once again. It was great to chat to you.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And if you're new to the podcast, by the way, the show notes are not just a bunch of bullet points about what we talked about, but not really saying anything. They are also not a full transcription of the entire almost 90-minute interview, but it's a summary. You can usually read it in, I would say, 5 to 10 minutes or so. So it's a detailed summary, detailed blog post, kind of long form written content, but nothing too crazy. So it's a really great way of going back and checking some points that you want to remind yourself of from the interview, or even to check before listening to the podcast to know whether a particular episode will interest you enough that you want to listen to it in full. And the show notes don't ever replace the entire interview or the entire episode, because the episode contains that much more nuance, but still, it's a very good way of getting a pretty detailed insight into what we talked about in a shorter amount of time than you would spend listening to the entire episode. So it has many use cases and lots of people like them, so check them out if you are not familiar with them already. In the next episode, I'm really excited for the topic that we have in store. We will talk about AI in training, in coaching, even in health and medicine, perhaps. And we will have an expert guest who is also a triathlete himself, but he does not work in the triathlon space, although he works with AI, more in the health and medicine space. So the reason for doing that is, I think that this gives us domain expertise with AI, of course, but also some domain understanding with triathlon. But importantly, because our guest is not working in triathlon, we will have more objectivity than we might have otherwise. So that's something that I think will help make the episode as informative as it can possibly be, but also have much less bias than it might have otherwise. So that's something that I'm really excited about. I haven't conducted the interview yet, but it's on the calendar to do in a week or so, and I have very high hopes for it. And before we finish off today, I want to remind you that we have 2 training camps in 2025, and they are still open for registration. We have the first camp on from the 5th to the 12th of April in Mallorca, and the second one from the 26th of April to the 3rd of May in the Algarve in Portugal. And for this second camp, the Algarve camp, we only have one final slot left available at the moment of recording, so it's best to get in your registration really quickly. With either one of these camps, you get to combine your passion for triathlon with experiencing some incredible locations and beautiful scenery, and a fantastic camaraderie with fellow triathletes. Of course, it's also a great opportunity to interact with us coaches and use it as a week to discuss training, learn more about how you might be able to further optimize your own training process, especially if you're self-coached. So the benefits you get don't stop at the immediate fitness boost of a big week of training, but hopefully you get some good learning and information to take with you home and that you can use for the rest of your career. As a special point on the program for the Mallorca camp, we will be doing an epic north to south ride that takes us through the entire Tramuntana mountain range from one end to the other. And this is for the more, let's say, the more advanced cycling group. So not everybody will or should do this ride, but we'll have one or two groups that will be doing this long ride and one or two groups doing shorter rides on that same day. So if you have the fitness, then this is something that you can look forward to, but you certainly don't have to have this level of fitness to join the camp, because we will have alternatives as well. To learn more about any of these camps, go to scientifictriathlon.com and click through to the training camp pages, or follow the links in the episode description. And if you have any questions, please email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and I hope to see you in a few months' time at a training camp. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. And thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.